This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. This is the author, James Nestor. At the end of this recording are step-by-step directions for the breathing techniques described throughout the chapters. Anders Olsen of Conscious Breathing will be leading these exercises. Feel free to visit this section if you'd like to breathe along as we go along. We begin with the Zhao Dynasty stone inscription from 500 BC. It reads, "In transporting the breath, the inhalation must be full. When it is full, it has big capacity. When it has big capacity, it can be extended. When it is extended, it can penetrate downward. When it penetrates downward, it will become calmly settled. When it is calmly settled, it will be strong and firm. The secret power of providence moves above. The secret power of the earth moves below. He who follows this will live. He who acts against this will die." Introduction. The place looked like something out of Amityville, all paint-chipped walls, dusty windows, and menacing shadows cast by moonlight. I walked through a gate, up a flight of creaking steps, and knocked on the door. When it swung open, a woman in her 30s with woolly eyebrows and oversized white teeth welcomed me inside. She asked me to take off my shoes, then led me to a cavernous living room, its ceiling painted sky blue with clouds. I took a seat beside a window that rattled in the breeze and watched through jaundiced streetlight as others walked in. A guy with prisoner eyes, a stern-faced man with Jerry Lewis bangs, a blonde woman with a bindi on her forehead. Through the rustle of shuffling feet and whispered hellos, I removed my belt, loosened the top button of my jeans, and settled in. I'd come here on the recommendation of my doctor, who told me a breathing class could help. It could help strengthen my failing lungs, calm my frazzled mind, and maybe give me perspective. For the past few months, I'd been going through a rough patch. My job was stressing me out, and my century-old house was falling apart. I'd just recovered from pneumonia, which I'd had the year before and the year before that. I was spending most of my time at home wheezing, working, and eating three meals a day out of the same bowl while hunched over a week-old newspaper on the couch. I was in a rut, physically, mentally, and otherwise. After a few months of living this way, I took my doctor's advice and signed up for an introductory course in breathing. At 7 p.m., the bushy-browed woman locked the door, sat in the middle of the group, inserted a cassette tape into a boombox, and pressed play. She told us to close our eyes. Through hissing static, the voice of a man with an Indian accent flowed from the speakers. It was squeaky and lilting, as if it had been taken from a cartoon. The voice instructed us to inhale slowly through our noses, then exhale slowly, to focus on our breath. We repeated this process for a few minutes. I reached over to a pile of blankets and wrapped one around my legs to keep me warm beneath the drafty window. I kept breathing, but nothing happened. No calmness swept over me, no tension released from my tight muscles. Nothing. 10, maybe 20 minutes passed. I started getting a little annoyed that I'd chosen to spend my evening inhaling dusty air in an old Victorian. I opened my eyes and looked around. Everyone had the same somber look. Prisoner eyes appeared to be sleeping. Jerry Lewis looked like he was relieving himself. Bindi sat frozen with a Cheshire cat smile on her face. I thought about getting up and leaving, but I didn't want to be rude. The session was free. The instructor wasn't paid to be here. I needed to respect her charity. So I closed my eyes again, wrapped the blanket a little tighter, and kept breathing. Something happened. I wasn't conscious of any transformation taking place. I never felt myself relax or the swarm of nagging thoughts leave my head, but it was as if I had been taken and deposited somewhere else. Time passed in an instant. The tape came to an end and I reopened my eyes. There was something wet on my head. I lifted my hand to wipe it off and noticed my hair was sopping. Then I felt the sting of sweat in my eyes and tasted salt. I looked down at my torso and noticed blotches on my sweater and jeans. The temperature in the room was about 68 degrees, much cooler beneath that drafty window. Everyone had been covered in jackets and hoodies to keep warm, but I had somehow sweated through my clothes as if I'd just run a marathon. The instructor approached and asked if I was okay, if I'd been sick or had a fever. I told her I felt perfectly fine. Then she said something about the body's heat, how inhaled breath provides us with new energy and exhaled breath releases old. I tried to take it all in but was having trouble focusing. I was preoccupied with how I was going to ride my bike home 3 miles from the Haight-Ashbury in sweat-soaked clothes. The next day, I felt even better. As advertised, there was a feeling of calm and quiet I hadn't experienced in a long time. I slept well. The little things in life didn't bother me as much. The tension was gone from my shoulders and neck. This lasted a few days before the feeling faded out. But what exactly happened? How did sitting cross-legged in a funky house and breathing for an hour trigger such a profound reaction? I returned to the class the next week. Same experience, fewer waterworks. I didn't mention any of this to my family or friends, but I wanted to understand the experience, and I spent the next several years trying to figure it out. Over that span of time, I fixed up my house, got out of my funk, and got a lead on what might answer some of my questions about breathing. I went to Greece to write a story about freediving, the ancient practice of plunging hundreds of feet below the water's surface on a single breath. Between dives, I interviewed dozens of experts, hoping to gain some perspective on what they did and why. I wanted to know how these unassuming people, these software engineers, executives, biologists, and physicians, had trained their bodies to go without air for minutes at a time, diving to depths far below what scientists thought possible. When most people go underwater, they bail out at 10 feet, ears screaming. These freedivers told me they'd been most people. Their transformation was a matter of training. They'd coaxed their lungs to work harder, to tap the pulmonary capabilities that the rest of us ignore. They insisted they weren't special. Anyone in reasonable health, willing to put in the hours, could dive to 100, 200, even 300 feet. It didn't matter how old you were, how much you weighed, or where you came from. To freedive, they said, all anyone had to do was master the art of breathing. To them, breathing wasn't an unconscious act. It wasn't just something they did. It was a force, a medicine, and a mechanism through which they could gain a kind of superhuman power. "There are as many ways to breathe as there are foods to eat," said one female instructor who had held her breath for more than 8 minutes and once dived to 300 feet. "And each way we breathe will affect our bodies in different ways." Another diver told me that some methods of breathing will nourish our brains, while others will kill neurons. Some will make us healthy, while others will hasten our death. They told me crazy stories about how they'd breathed in ways that expanded their lungs by 30% or more. They told me about an Indian doctor who lost several pounds simply by changing the way he inhaled, and another man who had been injected with E. coli, then breathed in ways to stimulate his immune system and destroy the toxins within minutes. They told me about women who put their cancers into remission and monks who could melt circles in the snow around their bare bodies. It all sounded nuts. During my off hours from doing underwater research, usually late at night, I read through reams of literature on the subject. Surely someone had studied the effects of conscious breathing on landlubbers. Surely someone had corroborated the freedivers' fantastic stories of weight loss, health, and longevity. I found a library's worth of material. The problem was, most sources were thousands of years old. 7 books of the Chinese Tao dating back to 400 BC focused entirely on breathing, how it could kill us or heal us, depending on how we used it. These manuscripts included detailed instructions on how to regulate breath, slow it, hold it, and even swallow it. Even earlier, Hindus considered breath and spirit the same thing and described elaborate practices that were meant to preserve both physical and mental health. Then there were the Buddhists, who use breathing not only to lengthen their lives, but to reach higher planes of consciousness. Breathing for all these people, for all these cultures, was powerful medicine. "Therefore, the scholar who nourishes his life refines the form and nourishes his breath," says an ancient Tao text. Isn't this evident? Not really. I look for some kind of verification of these claims in pulmonology, the medical discipline that deals with the lungs and the respiratory tract. I found next to nothing. According to what I did find, breathing technique wasn't important. Many doctors, researchers, and scientists confirm this position. 20 times a minute, 10 times, through the mouth, nose, or breathing tube, it's all the same. The point was to get air in and let the body do the rest. To get a sense of how breathing is regarded in modern medicine, think back to your last checkup. Chances are your doctor took your blood pressure, pulse, and temperature, then placed a stethoscope to your chest and listened to your heartbeat. Maybe she discussed diet, taking vitamins, or stresses at work. Any issues digesting food? How about sleep? Were those allergies getting worse? What about those headaches? But she likely never discussed your respiratory rate. She never checked the balance of oxygen and carbon dioxide in your bloodstream. How you breathe and the quality of each breath were not on the menu. Even so, if the freedivers and ancients were to be believed, how we breathe affects all these things. How could it be so important and unimportant at the same time? I kept digging, and slowly a story began to unfold. As I found out, I was not the only person who'd recently started asking these questions. While I was paging through texts and interviewing freedivers and other super breathers, scientists at Harvard, Stanford, and other institutions were confirming some of the wildest stories I'd been hearing. But their work wasn't happening in pulmonology labs. Pulmonologists, I learned, work mainly on the maladies of the lungs, the collapse, the cancers, and the emphysema. No, this breathing research was taking place elsewhere, in the muddy digs of ancient burial sites, the easy chairs of dental offices, and the rubber rooms of mental hospitals. Few of these scientists set out to study breathing, but somehow, in some way, breathing kept finding them. They discovered that our capacity to inhale and exhale had changed over the long processes of human evolution. They discovered that today, 90% of us, very likely me, you, and everyone you know, are breathing incorrectly, and this failure is either causing or aggravating a laundry list of diseases. On a more inspiring note, some of these researchers were also showing that many modern maladies, all that asthma, anxiety, and even hypertension and psoriasis, these could either be reduced or reversed simply by changing the way we breathe. This work was upending long-held beliefs in Western medical science. Yes, breathing in different patterns really can influence our body weight and overall health. Yes, how we breathe really does affect the size and function of our lungs. Yes, we can use breathing to hack into our nervous system, control our immune response, and restore health. Yes, changing how we breathe will help us live longer. No matter what we eat, how much we exercise, how skinny or young or wise we are, none of it will matter unless we're breathing correctly. That's what these researchers discovered. The missing pillar in health is breath. It all starts there. This book is a scientific adventure into the lost art and science of breathing. It explores the transformation that occurs in our bodies every 3.3 seconds, the time it takes the average person to inhale and exhale. It explains how the billions and billions of molecules you bring in with each breath have built your bones, muscles, blood, and brains. It explains the emerging science of how these microscopic bits will influence your health and happiness tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, and decades from now. I call this a lost art because so many of these new discoveries aren't new at all. Most of the techniques I'll be exploring have been around for hundreds or thousands of years. They were created, documented, forgotten, and discovered in another culture at another time, then forgotten again. This went on for centuries. Many pioneers in this discipline weren't scientists. They were tinkers, a kind of rogue group I call pulmonauts, who stumbled on the powers of breathing because nothing else could help them. They were Civil War surgeons, French hairdressers, anarchist opera singers, Indian mystics, irritable swim coaches, Ukrainian cardiologists, and North Carolina choral conductors. Few of these pulmonauts achieved much fame or respect when they were alive. When they died, their research was buried and scattered. Was even more fascinating to learn that during the past few years, their techniques had been rediscovered, tested, and proven. The fruits of this once fringe, often forgotten science are now redefining the potential of the human body. But why do I need to learn how to breathe? I've been breathing my whole life. This question, and you may be asking it right now, has been popping up ever since I began my research. We assume, at our peril, that breathing is a passive action, just something that we do. Breathe, live, stop breathing, die. But breathing is not binary. and the more I immersed myself in the subject, the more personally invested I felt about sharing this basic truth. Like most adults, I too have suffered from a host of respiratory problems throughout my life. That's what landed me in that breathing class years ago. And like most people, I found that no allergy drug, inhaler, mix of supplements, or diet did much good. In the end, it was a new generation of pulmonauts who offered me a cure, and then they offered me so much more. It will take you about 10,000 breaths to listen from here to the end of this book. If I've done my job correctly, starting now, with every breath you take, you'll have a deeper understanding of breathing and how best to do it. 20 times a minute, 10 times, through the mouth, nose, tracheostomy, or breathing tube, it's not all the same. How we breathe really matters. By your 1,000th breath, you'll understand why modern humans are the only species with chronically crooked teeth and why that's relevant to breathing. You'll know how our ability to breathe has deteriorated over the ages and why our caveman ancestors probably didn't snore. You'll have followed two middle-aged men as they struggled through a pioneering and masochistic 20-day study at Stanford University. Some of what you'll learn will ruin your days and nights, especially if you snore. But in your next breaths, you'll find remedies. By your 3,000th breath, you'll know the basics of restorative breathing. These slow and long techniques are open to everyone, old and young, sick and healthy, rich and poor. They've been practiced in Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, and other religions for thousands of years, but only recently have we learned how they can reduce blood pressure, boost athletic performance, and balance the nervous system. By your 6,000th breath, you'll have moved into the land of serious conscious breathing. You'll travel past the mouth and nose deeper into the lungs, and you'll meet a mid-century pulmonaut who healed patients of emphysema and trained Olympic sprinters to win gold medals, all by harnessing the power of the exhale. By your 8,000th breath, you'll have pushed even deeper into the body to tap, of all things, the nervous system. You'll discover the art of overbreathing. You'll meet the pulmonauts who have used these practices to straighten scoliotic spines, blunt autoimmune disease, and superheat themselves in sub-zero temperatures. None of this should be possible, and yet, as you will hear, it is. Along the way, I'll be learning too, trying to understand what happened to me in that Victorian house a decade ago. By your 10,000th breath, and the end of this book, you and I will know how the air that enters your lungs affects every moment of your life and how to harness it to its full potential until your final breath. This book will explore many things: evolution, medical history, biochemistry, physiology, physics, and more. But mostly, it will explore you. By the law of averages, you will take 670 million breaths in your lifetime. Maybe you've already taken half of those. Maybe you're on breath 669 million. Maybe you'd like to take a few million more. Part 1, The Experiment. Chapter 1, The Worst Breathers in the Animal Kingdom. The patient arrived, pale and torpid, at 9:32 a.m. Male, middle-aged, 175 pounds. Talkative and friendly, but visibly anxious. Pain? None. Fatigue? A little. Level of anxiety? Moderate. Fears about progression of future symptoms? High. Patient reported that he was raised in a modern suburban environment, bottle-fed at 6 months, and weaned onto jarred commercial foods. The lack of chewing associated with this diet stunted bone development in his dental arches and sinus cavities, leading to chronic nasal congestion. By age 15, patient was subsisting on even softer, highly processed foods, mostly white bread, sweetened juices, canned vegetables, steakums, Velveeta sandwiches, microwave taquitos, Hostess snowballs, and Reggie bars. His mouth had become so underdeveloped it could not accommodate 32 permanent teeth. Incisors and canines grew in crooked. He required extractions, braces, retainers, and headgear. 3 years of orthodontics made his small mouth even smaller, so his tongue no longer properly fit between his teeth. When he stuck it out, which he did often, visible imprints laced its sides, a precursor to snoring. At 17, 4 impacted wisdom teeth were removed, which further decreased the size of his mouth while increasing his chances of developing sleep apnea. As he aged into his 20s and 30s, his breathing became more labored and dysfunctional, and his airways became more obstructed. His face would continue a vertical growth pattern that led to sagging eyes, doughy cheeks, and a sloping forehead. This atrophied, underdeveloped mouth, throat, and skull, unfortunately, belongs to me. I'm lying on the examination chair of the Stanford Otolaryngology Center. I'm looking at myself, looking into myself. For the past several minutes, Dr. Jayankar Nayak has been gingerly coaxing an endoscope camera through my nose. He's gone so deep into my head that he's come out the other side, into my throat. "Say E," he says. Nayak has a halo of black hair, square glasses, and a white coat, but I'm not looking at his clothes or his face. I'm wearing a pair of video goggles that are streaming a live feed of the journey through the rolling dunes, marshes, and stalactites inside my severely damaged sinuses. I'm trying not to cough or choke or gag as the endoscope squirms a little further down. "Say E," Nayak repeats. I say it and watch as the soft tissue around my larynx opens and closes like a stop-motion Georgia O'Keeffe flower. This isn't a pleasure cruise. 25 sextillion molecules take the same voyage 18 times a minute, 25,000 times a day. I've come here to see, feel, and learn where all this air is supposed to enter our bodies. I've come to say goodbye to my nose for the next 10 days. For the past century, the prevailing belief in Western medicine was that the nose was more or less an ancillary organ. We should breathe out of it if we can, but if not, no problem. That's what the mouth is for. Many doctors, researchers, and scientists still support this position. There are 27 departments at the National Institutes of Health devoted to lungs, eyes, and ears, and so on. The nose and sinuses aren't represented in any of them. Nayak finds this absurd. He is the chief of rhinology research at Stanford. He heads a renowned laboratory focused entirely on understanding the hidden power of the nose. He's found that those dunes, stalactites, and marshes inside the human head orchestrate a multitude of functions, vital functions. "Those structures are in there for a reason," he told me earlier. Nayak has a special reverence for the nose, which he believes is greatly underappreciated, which is why he's so interested to see what happens to a body that functions without one, which is what has brought me here. Starting today, I'll spend the next 250,000 breaths with silicone plugs blocking my nostrils to stop even the faintest amount of air from entering or exiting my nose. I'll breathe only through my mouth, a heinous experiment that will be exhausting and miserable, but has a clear point. 40% of today's population suffers from chronic nasal obstruction, and around half of us are habitual mouth breathers, with females and children suffering the most. The causes are many: dry air to stress, inflammation to allergies, pollution to pharmaceuticals. But much of the blame, I'll soon learn, can be placed on the ever-shrinking real estate in the front of the human skull. When mouths don't grow wide enough, the roof tends to rise up instead of out, forming what's called a V-shaped palate. The upward growth impedes the development of the nasal cavity, shrinking it and disrupting the delicate structures in the nose. Overall, humans have the sad distinction of being the most plugged-up species on Earth. I should know. Before probing my nasal cavities, Nayak took an X-ray of my head, which provided a deli-slicer view of every nook and cranny. "You've got some stuff," he said. Not only did I have that V-shaped palate, I also had severe obstruction to my left nostril caused by a severely deviated septum. My sinuses were also riddled with deformities called concha bullosa. "Super uncommon," said Nayak. It was a phrase nobody wants to hear from a doctor. In fact, my airways were such a mess that Nayak was amazed I hadn't suffered from even more of the infections and respiratory problems I'd known as a kid. But he was reasonably certain I could expect some degree of serious breathing problems in the future. Over the next 10 days of forced mouth breathing, I'll be putting myself into a kind of mucusy crystal ball, amplifying and hastening the deleterious effects on my breathing, which will be getting worse the older I get. I'll be lulling myself into a state it already knows, that half the population knows, only multiplying it many times. Okay, steady, Nyack says. He grabs a steel needle with a wire brush at the end of it. It's about the size of a Q-tip. I'm thinking, he's not going to be putting that thing up my nose. A few seconds later, he does just that. I watch through the video goggles as Nyack maneuvers the brush deeper. He keeps sliding until it's no longer up my nose, no longer playing around with my nasal hair, but wiggling inside of my head a few inches deep. Steady, steady, he says. When the nasal cavity gets congested, airflow decreases and bacteria flourish. This leads to infections and colds. Congestion begets congestion, which gives us no other option but to breathe through the mouth. Nobody knows how soon this damage occurs. Nobody knows how quickly bacteria accumulate in a plugged-up nasal cavity. Nyack needs to grab a culture of my deep tissue to find out. I wince as I watch him twist the brush deeper still, then spin it, skimming off a layer of gunk. The nerves this far up the nose are designed to feel the subtle flow of air and slight modulations in temperature, not steel brushes. Even though he's dabbed anesthetic in there, I can still feel it. My brain has a hard time knowing how to react. It's difficult to explain, but it feels as if someone's needling a conjoined twin that exists somewhere outside of my body. The things you never thought you'd be doing in your life, Nyack laughs, putting the bleeding tip of the brush in the test tube. He'll compare this sample with another 10 days from now and see how nasal obstruction affects bacterial growth. He shakes the tube, hands it to his assistant, and politely asks me to make room for the next patient. Patient number two is leaning against the window and snapping photos with his phone. He's 49 years old, deeply tanned, with white hair and smurf blue eyes. He's wearing spotless beige jeans and leather loafers without socks. His name is Anders Olsen, and he's flown 5,000 miles from Stockholm, Sweden. Along with me, he's ponied up more than $6,000 to join this experiment. I'd interviewed Olsen several months ago after coming across his website. It had all the red flags of flakiness: stock images of blonde women striking hero poses on mountaintops, neon colors, and frantic use of exclamation marks. But Olsen wasn't some fringe character. He'd spent a decade collecting and conducting serious scientific research. He'd written dozens of posts and self-published a book explaining breathing from the subatomic level on up, all annotated with hundreds of references. He'd also become one of Scandinavia's most respected and popular therapists, helping to heal thousands of patients through the subtle power of healthy breathing. When I mentioned during one of our Skype conversations that I would be mouth-breathing for 10 days during an experiment, he cringed. When I asked if he wanted to join in, he refused. "I do not want to," he declared. "But I am curious." Now, months later, Olsen plops his jet-lagged body onto the examination chair, puts on the video glasses, inhales one last nasal breath for the next 240 hours. Beside him, Nyack twirls the steel endoscope the way a heavy metal drummer handles a drumstick. "Okay, lean your head back," says Nyack. A twist of the wrist, a crane of the neck, and he goes deep. The experiment is set up in two phases. Phase one consists of plugging our noses and attempting to live our everyday lives. We'll eat, exercise, and sleep as usual, only we'll do it while breathing only through our mouths. In phase two, we'll eat, drink, and exercise and sleep just as we did, but we'll switch the pathway to our noses and practice a number of breathing techniques throughout the day. Between phases, we'll return to Stanford and repeat all the tests we've just taken. Blood gases, inflammatory markers, hormone levels, smell, pulmonary function, and more. Nyack will compare the data and see what, if anything, changed in our brains and bodies as we shifted our style of breathing. I'd gotten a fair share of warnings from friends when I told them about the experiment. "Don't do it," they said. But most people just shrugged. "I haven't breathed through my nose in a decade," said a friend who had suffered allergies most of his life. Everyone else said the equivalent of, "What's the big deal? Breathing is breathing." Is it? Olsen and I will spend the next 20 days finding out. A while back, some 4 billion years ago, our earliest ancestors appeared on some rocks. We were small then, a microscopic ball of sludge, and we were hungry. We needed energy to live and proliferate, so we found a way to eat air. The atmosphere was mostly carbon dioxide, not the best fuel, but it worked well enough. These early versions of us learned to take this gas in, break it down, and spit out what was left, oxygen. For the next billion years, this primordial goo kept doing this, eating more gas, making more sludge, and excreting more oxygen. Then, around 2.5 billion years ago, there was enough oxygen waste in the atmosphere that a scavenger version of us emerged to make use of it. It learned to gulp in all that leftover oxygen and excrete carbon dioxide. This was the first cycle of aerobic life. Oxygen, it turned out, produced 16 times more energy than carbon dioxide. Aerobic life forms used this boost to evolve, to leave the sludge-covered rocks behind and grow larger and more complex. They crawled up to land, dove deep into the sea, and flew into the air. They became plants, trees, birds, bees, and the earliest mammals. These mammals grew noses to warm and purify air, throats to guide it into lungs, and a network of sacs that would remove oxygen from the atmosphere and transfer it into the blood. The aerobic cells that once clung to swampy rocks so many eons ago now made up the tissues in mammalian bodies. These cells took oxygen from our blood and returned carbon dioxide, which traveled through our veins, through the lungs, and back out into the world. This was the process of breathing. The ability to breathe so efficiently in a wide variety of ways, consciously and unconsciously, fast, slow, and not at all, allowed our ancient ancestors to catch prey, escape predators, and get a foothold on Earth. It was all going so well until about 1.5 million years ago, when the pathways through which we took in and exhaled air began to shift and fissure. It was a shift that, much later in history, would affect the breathing of every person now living. I've been feeling these cracks for much of my life, and chances are you have too. Snoring, some degree of wheezing, maybe asthma, allergies, and all the rest. I'd always thought that they were a normal part of being human. Nearly everyone I knew suffered from one problem or another. But I came to learn that these problems didn't randomly develop. Something caused them, and the answers could be found in a common and homely trait. A few months before the Stanford experiment, I flew to Philadelphia to visit Dr. Mariana Evans, an orthodontist and dental researcher who spent the last several years looking into the mouths of human skulls. We were standing in the basement of the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, surrounded by several hundred ancient specimens. Each was engraved with letters and numbers and stamped with its race. There were Brazilian prostitutes, Arab slaves, and Persian prisoners. The most famous specimen, I was told, came from an Irish prisoner who'd been hanged in 1824 for killing and eating his fellow convicts. The skulls range from 200 to thousands of years old. They were part of the Morton collection, named after a racist scientist named Samuel Morton, who starting in the 1830s collected skeletons in a failed attempt to prove the superiority of the Caucasian race. The only positive outcome of Morton's work was that the skulls he spent so many years gathering now provide a snapshot of how people used to look and how they used to breathe. Where Morton claimed to see inferior races and genetic degradation, Evans and her colleagues discovered perfection. To demonstrate what she meant, she walked over to a cabinet and retrieved a skull marked Parsi for Persian. She wiped bone dust on the sleeve of her cashmere sweater and ran a neatly trimmed fingernail along its jaw and face. "These are twice as large as they are today," she said in a Ukrainian accent. She was pointing at the nasal apertures, the two holes that connect to the back of the throat. She turned the skull around so that it was staring at us. "So wide and pronounced," she said approvingly. Evans and her colleague, Dr. Kevin Boyd, a Chicago-based pediatric dentist, had spent the last 4 years x-raying more than 100 skulls from the Morton collection and measuring the angles from the top of the ear to the nose and from the forehead to the chin. These measurements, called the Frankfurt plane and the end perpendicular, show the symmetry of each specimen, how well proportioned the mouth was relative to the face, the nose to the palate, and, to a large extent, how well the people who owned these skulls might have breathed. Every one of the ancient skulls was identical to that Parsi example. They all had enormous forward-facing jaws. They had expansive sinus cavities and broad mouths. And bizarrely, even though none of these ancient people had ever flossed or brushed or saw a dentist, they all had straight teeth. These people very likely never snored or had sleep apnea or sinusitis or many of the other chronic respiratory problems that affect modern populations. They did not because they could not. Their mouths were far too large and their airways too wide for anything to block them. They breathed easy. Nearly all ancient humans shared this forward structure, not just in the Morton collection, but everywhere around the world. This remained true from the time when Homo sapiens first appeared on Earth 300,000 years ago to just a few hundred years ago. Evans and Boyd then compared the ancient specimens to modern skulls of their own patients and others. Every modern skull had the opposite growth pattern, meaning the angles of the Frankfurt plane and end perpendicular were reversed. Chins had recessed behind foreheads. Jaws were slumped, sinuses shrunken. All the modern skulls showed some degree of crooked teeth. Of the 5,400 different species of mammals on the planet, humans are now the only ones to routinely have misaligned jaws, overbites, underbites, and snaggled teeth, a condition called malocclusion. To Evans, this raises a fundamental question. Why would we evolve to make ourselves sick? She asked. She put the Parsi skull back in the cabinet and took out another labeled Saccard. Its perfect facial form was a mirror of the others. She explained that evolution doesn't always mean progress. It means change, and life can change for better or for worse. Today, the human body is changing in ways that have nothing to do with survival of the fittest. Instead, we're adopting and passing down traits that are detrimental to our health. This concept, called disevolution, was made popular by Harvard biologist Daniel Lieberman. And it explains why our backs ache, feet hurt, and bones are growing more brittle. Disevolution also helps explain why we're breathing so poorly. To understand how all this happened and why, Evans told me we need to go back in time, way back to before Homo sapiens were even sapiens. What strange creatures we were, standing in the tall grass of the savanna, all gangly-armed and pointy-elbowed, gazing out into the wide, wild world. As the breeze swayed the grass, our nostrils, the size of gumdrops, flexed vertically above our chinless mouths, picking up whatever scents wafted in. The time was about 1.7 million years ago, and the first human ancestor, Homo habilis, was roaming the eastern shores of Africa. We'd long since left the trees, learned to walk on our legs, and trained ourselves to use the small finger on the inside of our hands to turn it upside down into an opposable thumb. We used these digits to grab things, to pull plants and roots and grasses from the ground, and to build hunting tools from stone that were sharp enough to carve tongues out of antelope and strip meat from the bone. Eating this raw diet took a lot of time and energy. So we gathered stones and bashed prey against rocks. This spared us some of the effort of digesting and chewing, which saved energy. We used this extra energy to grow a larger brain. Around 800,000 years ago, we began processing food and fire, which released an additional amount of calories. Our large intestines, which helped break down raw foods, shrank considerably under this new diet, and that change alone saved even more energy. These more modern ancestors, Homo erectus, used it to grow an even bigger brain, an astounding 50% larger than the habilis. We began to look less like apes and more like people. If you could take a Homo erectus, dress him up in a Brooks Brothers suit, and put him on a subway, he probably wouldn't draw a second glance. These ancestors were genetically similar enough to possibly have had our children. The innovation of mashing and cooking food, however, had consequences. The quickly growing brain needed space to stretch out, and it took it from the front of our faces. Over time, the muscles at the center of the face loosened, and bones in the jaw weakened and grew thinner. The face shortened and the mouth shrank, leaving behind a bony protuberance that replaced the squashed snout. This new feature was ours alone and distinguished us from other primates, the protruding nose. The problem was the smaller, vertically positioned nose was less efficient at filtering air, and it exposed us to more pathogens and bacteria. The smaller sinuses and mouth also reduced the space in our throats. The more we cooked, the more soft, calorie-rich food we consumed, the larger our brains grew, and the tighter our airways became. Homo sapiens first emerged on the African savanna around 300,000 years ago. We were among a coterie of other human species. Homo heidelbergensis, a robust creature who built shelters and hunted game in what is now Europe. Neanderthals, with their massive noses and stunted limbs, who learned to make clothes and flourish in frigid environments. And then there was the Homo naledi, a throwback to early ancestors with tiny brains, flared hips, spindly arms that hung down from squat bodies. What a sight it must have been, these ragtag species all gathered around a blazing campfire at night, a Star Wars cantina of early humanity, together sipping river water from palm cups, picking grubs from each other's hair, comparing the ridges of their brows, and scampering off behind the boulders to have interspecies sex beneath the glow of starlight. Then, no more. The big-nosed Neanderthals, the scrawny Naledi, the thick-neck Heidelbergensis were all killed off by disease, weather, each other, or laziness, or something else. There was only one human left in the long family tree. Us. In colder climates, our nose would grow narrower and longer to more efficiently heat up air before it entered our lungs. In sunny and warm environments, we adapted wider and flatter noses, which were more efficient at inhaling hot and humid air. Along the way, the larynx would descend in the throat to accommodate another adaptation, vocal communication. The larynx works as a valve to shuttle food into the stomach and protect us from inhaling it. Every animal and every other Homo species had evolved a higher larynx located towards the top of the throat. This made sense, since a high larynx functions most efficiently, allowing the body to rid itself quickly should anything get stuck in our airways. As humans developed speech, the larynx sank, opening up space in the back of the mouth and allowing a wider range of vocalizations and volumes. But this lowered larynx became less efficient at its original purpose. It created too much space at the back of the mouth and made early humans susceptible to choking. We could choke if we swallowed something too big, and we could choke on smaller objects that were swallowed too quickly or too sloppily. Sapiens would become the only animals and the only human species that could easily choke on food and die. Strangely, sadly, the same adaptations that would allow our ancestors to outwit, outmaneuver, and outlive other animals, that mastery of fire and processing food, that enormous brain and the ability to communicate in a vast range of sounds, all these things would obstruct our mouths and throats and make it harder for us to breathe. This recessed growth would, much later, make us prone to choke on our own bodies as we slept, to snore. None of this mattered to early humans, of course. For tens of thousands of years, our ancestors used these wildly developed heads to breathe just fine. Armed with a nose, a voice, and an intellect, humans took over the world. I'd been thinking about our hirsute forebears ever since I'd visited Evans months back. There they were, crouched along the rocky African shore, pulling in easy breaths through gaping nasal apertures and chomping on braised rabbit with perfect teeth. And here I am, slack-jawed under an LED light, staring at a Wikipedia page on my phone, chewing bits of a low-carb nutritional bar with my crooked teeth, coughing and wheezing and sucking exactly no air through my obstructed nose. It's evening on the second day of the Stanford mouth-breathing experiment, and I'm in bed with silicone plugs jammed inside of my nostrils, covered with tape. For the past few nights, I've been splayed out in a part of my house usually reserved for relatives or friends. but I had a feeling that my mouth-breathing lifestyle might be a challenge for my wife. Lying here, tossing and turning, thinking about cavemen and unable to sleep, I'm happy I moved. I've got a pulse oximeter device about the size of a matchbook strapped to my wrist and a glowing red wire around my middle finger. Every few seconds, the device records my heart rate and blood oxygen levels and uses this information to assess how often and how severely my tongue might get lodged in my too small mouth and cause me to hold my breath, a condition more commonly known as sleep apnea. To gauge the severity of my snoring and apnea, I've downloaded a phone app that records a constant stream of audio throughout the night, then provides a minute-to-minute graph of my breathing health every morning. A security camera just above the bed monitors every movement. Inflammation in the throat and polyps both contribute to snoring and sleep apnea. Nasal obstruction triggers this nighttime choking as well, but nobody knows how quickly the damage comes on, or how severe it might become, because until now, nobody has tested it. Last night, in my first run of plugged-up sleeping, my snoring increased by 1,300% to 75 minutes throughout the night. Olson's numbers were even worse. He went from 0 to 4 hours. I'd also suffered a fourfold increase in sleep apnea events. All this in just 24 hours. Now, lying here again, no matter how I try to relax and submit to this experiment, it's a challenge. Every 3.3 seconds, another blast of unfiltered, unmoistened, and unheated air enters through my mouth, drying my tongue, irritating my throat, and pissing off my lungs. And I've got 175,000 more breaths to go. Chapter 2. Mouth breathing. It's 8:15 a.m., and Olson bursts in, Kramer style, through the side door. "Good morning," he shouts. He has little balls of silicone lodged up his nose and is wearing cut-off sweatpants and an Abercrombie and Fitch sweatshirt. Olson rented a studio across the street from me for a month, close enough to sneak over wearing his pajamas, but not close enough to avoid looking like a freak doing it. His face, once tan and bright, is now gaunt and sallow. He looks like Gary Busey in that mugshot from years past. He has the same spaced-out expression he had yesterday, the same haunted grin he wore the day before and the day before that. Today marks the halfway point of the mouth-breathing phase of the experiment, and today, like every other day, as he's been doing for 3 times a day, morning, noon, and night, Olson takes a seat across from me. 1, 2, 3, we flip on a pile of beeping and burping machines lumped on the table, strap cuffs to our arms, place sensors to our ears, stick thermometers in our mouths, and begin recording our physiological data on spreadsheets. The readouts reveal what the previous days have revealed. Mouth breathing is destroying our health. My blood pressure has spiked by an average of 13 points from where it was before the test, which puts me deep into stage 1 hypertension. If left unchecked, the state of chronically raised blood pressure, also shared by a third of the U.S. population, can cause heart attacks, stroke, and other serious problems. Meanwhile, my heart rate variability, a measure of nervous system balance, has plummeted, suggesting that my body is in a state of stress. Then there's my pulse, which has increased, my body temperature, which has decreased, and my mental clarity, which has hit rock bottom. Olson's data mirrors mine. But the worst part about all of this is how we feel. Awful. Every day, it all seems to be getting worse. And every day, at this exact time, Olson finishes his last test, removes the respirator mask from his cotton-white hair. He stands up and jams the silicone plugs a little deeper into his nostrils. He puts on his sweatshirt, then walks out the door. I nod and watch as he trots his slippered feet through the hallways and back across the street. The final testing protocol, eating, happens alone. Through both phases of the experiment, we'll be consuming the same food at the same time while taking the same amount of steps throughout the day to see how mouth breathing and nasal breathing might affect weight and metabolism. Today, it's 3 eggs, half an avocado, a piece of German brown bread, and a pot of Lapsang tea. Which means that 10 days from now, I will again be sitting here in this kitchen, eating the same meal. Scarf down breakfast, I do the dishes, I clean up some old filters on the dining room table, and then answer some emails. On some days, Olsen and I sit around and experiment with more comfortable and effective ways to keep our noses blocked. Waterproof earplugs, which were too hard, foam earplugs, which were too soft, a swimmer's nose clip, which was too painful, a CPAP nose pillow, comfortable but it looks like a bondage device, toilet paper, which was way too airy, chewing gum, which was too slimy, and finally, surgical tape over earplugs, which is chafing and stifling, but the least atrocious of the options. But most of the time, all day, every day, for the past several days, Olsen and I just sit around alone in our apartments and hate life. I often feel as though I'm trapped in some sad sitcom in which nobody laughs, a Groundhog Day of perpetual and unending misery. Luckily, today is a little different. Today, Olsen and I are going on a bike ride. Not on a beach boardwalk or in the shadow of the Golden Gate, but inside the concrete walls of a neighborhood gym. The cycling was Olsen's idea. He'd spent years researching the differences in performance between nasal breathers and mouth breathers during intense exercise. He'd conducted his own studies on CrossFit athletes, and he'd worked with coaches. He'd become convinced that mouth breathing can put the body into a state of stress that can make us more quickly fatigue and sap athletic performance. He insisted that, for a few days during each phase of the experiment, we saddle up on a stationary bike at the neighborhood gym and pedal to the edge of our aerobic capacity. I put on some shorts, grabbed the fitness tracker, a water bottle, and exit through the backyard. Waiting by the fence is Antonio, a contractor and longtime friend who has been doing renovation work on the upper floor of my house. He looks over, and before I can beeline to the garden exit, he notices the pink earplugs in my nose. He drops an armful of 2x4s and comes over to take a closer look. I'd known Antonio for about 15 years, and he'd heard about all the oddball stories I've written in far-off places. He'd always been interested and supportive. That ended when I tell him what I've been up to this week. "This is a bad idea," he says. "In school, when I was young, teachers walked around the classroom, man, and pop, pop, pop." He smacks the back of his head for emphasis here. "You're breathing from your mouth, you get a pop." Mouth breathing leads to sickness and is disrespectful, he told me, which is why he and everyone else he grew up with in Puebla, Mexico, learned to breathe from the nose. Antonio told me his partner, Janet, suffers from chronic obstruction and runny nose. Janet's son, Anthony, is also a chronic mouth breather. He started to suffer the same problems. "I keep telling them this is bad. They try to fix it," Antonio said. "But it's hard, man." I'd heard a similar story from a British man named David a few years ago when Olsen and I were attempting our first nasal obstructed jog. He stopped us and asked what we were doing. Then he told us he'd had obstruction issues his whole life. He'd spent the last 20 years squirting various drugs up his nostrils, but they became less effective over time. Now he'd developed chronic respiratory problems. To avoid hearing any more of these stories and to evade any more unwanted attention, I'd learned to go outside only when I had to. Don't get me wrong, San Franciscans love weirdos. There was once a guy who used to walk down Haight Street with a hole in the back of his jeans so that his tail, an actual human tail about 5 inches long, could swing freely behind him. He hardly got second glances. But the sight of Olsen and me with plugs and tape and whatever else in and around our noses has proven too much for the locals to bear. Everywhere we go, we get either questioned or someone's long life story of breathing woes. How he had allergies his whole life. How she was sleeping worse and worse. How hard it was to just get a breath. I wave goodbye to Antonio and then jog a few blocks to the gym. I make my way around women speed walking on treadmills and old men on weight machines. I can't help but notice all of them are mouth breathing. Then I boot up the pulse oximeter, hop on a stationary bike, latch my feet to the pedals, and I'm off. The bike experiment is a repeat of several studies conducted 20 years earlier by Dr. John Duyar, a trainer of elite athletes from tennis star Billie Jean King to the New Jersey Nets. In the 1990s, Duyar became convinced that mouth breathing was hurting his clients. To prove it, he gathered a group of professional cyclists, rigged them up with sensors to record their heart rate and breathing rates, and put them on stationary bikes. Over several minutes, Duyar increased the resistance on the pedal, requiring the athletes to exert progressively more energy as the experiment went on. During the first trial, Duyar told the athletes to breathe entirely through their mouths. As the intensity increased, so did the rate of their breathing, which was expected. By the time athletes reached the hardest stage of the test, pedaling out 200 watts of power, they were panting and struggling to catch a breath. Then Duyar repeated the test while the athletes breathed entirely through their noses. As the intensity of exercise increased during this phase, the rate of breathing decreased. At the final 200-watt stage, one subject, who had been mouth breathing at a rate of 47 breaths per minute, was nasal breathing just 14 breaths. He maintained the same heart rate at which he'd started the test, even though the intensity of the exercise had increased tenfold. Simply training yourself to breathe through your nose, Duyar reported, could cut total exertion in half and offer huge gains in endurance. The athletes felt invigorated while nasal breathing rather than exhausted. They all swore off breathing through their mouths ever again. Back at the gym, I'll follow Duyard's test protocol for the next 30 minutes, but instead of measuring exertion with weight, I'll use distance. I'll keep my heart rate locked in at a consistent 130 beats per minute while measuring how far I can go with my nose plugged and breathing only from my mouth. Olson and I will come back here next week and do these same tests while breathing only through our noses. The data will provide a general overview of how mouth and nasal breathing affect athletic performance. To understand how this all works, we first need to understand how the body makes energy from air and food. There are two options: with oxygen, a process known as aerobic respiration, and without it, called anaerobic respiration. Anaerobic energy is generated only with glucose, and it's quicker and easier for our bodies to access. It's a kind of backup system and turbo boost when the body doesn't have enough oxygen. But anaerobic energy is inefficient and can be toxic, creating an excess of lactic acid. That nausea, muscle weakness, and sweating you experience after you've pushed it too hard at the gym is the feeling of anaerobic overload. Essentially, anaerobic energy is like a muscle car. It's fast and responsive for quick trips, but polluting and impractical for long hauls. This is why aerobic respiration is so important. Remember those cells that evolved to eat oxygen 2.5 billion years ago and kicked off that explosion of life? We've got some 37 trillion of them in our bodies. When we run our cells aerobically with oxygen, we gain some 16 times more energy efficiency over anaerobic. The key for exercise and for the rest of life is to stay in that energy-efficient, clean-burning, oxygen-eating aerobic zone for the majority of time during exercise and at all times during rest. Back in the gym, I pedal a little harder, breathe a little deeper, and watch as my heart rate steadily increases. Over the next 3 minutes of this warm-up, I'll need to get to 136 and keep it there for a half hour. This rate should be right at the aerobic-anaerobic threshold for a man my age. Finding the best heart rate for exercise is easy. Just subtract your age from 180. The result is the maximum your body can withstand to stay in the aerobic zone. Long bouts of training and exercise can happen below this rate, but never above it. Otherwise, the body will risk going too deep into the anaerobic zone for too long. Instead of feeling invigorated and strong after a workout, you'll feel tired, shaky, and nauseated, which is exactly what happens to me. After I do a half hour of vigorous pedaling and open-mouth huffing, the clock on the stationary bike ticks down to zero, and the whirling gears slow to a stop. I'm sweating profusely and feel bleary-eyed, but I've pedaled a total of only 6.4 miles. I scoot off the bike and let Olsen take a spin, then it's back to the home lab for a shower, glass of water, and more testing. Decades before Olsen and I jammed our noses shut, and before Dulyar put his cyclists through the rounds, scientists were running their own test on the pros and cons of mouth breathing. There was Austin Young, an enterprising doctor in England, who in the 1960s treated a slew of chronic nosebleeders by sewing their nostrils shut. One of Young's followers, Valerie J. Lund, revived the process 40 years later and stitched the nostrils of dozens of patients. I tried to contact Lund to ask how her mouth-breathing patients fared after weeks, months, and years, but I never got a reply. Luckily, those consequences were spelled out by an orthodontist and researcher chasing very different ends. Egil Harvold's hideous experiments in the 1980s would not go over well with PETA or anyone else who has really cared for animals. Working from a lab in San Francisco, he gathered a troop of monkeys and stuffed silicone deep into the nasal cavities of half of them, leaving the other half as they were. The obstructed animals couldn't remove the plugs, and they couldn't breathe at all through their noses. They were forced to adapt to constant mouth breathing. Over the next 6 months, Harvold measured the animals' dental arches, the angles of their chins, the length of their faces, and more. The plugged-up monkeys developed the same downward growth pattern, the same narrowing of the dental arch and gaping mouth. Harvold repeated these experiments, keeping the animals obstructed for 2 years. They fared even worse. Along the way, he took a lot of pictures. The photographs are heart-wrenching, not only for the sake of the poor monkeys, but because they offer such a clear reflection of our own species. After just a few months, our faces too can grow long, slack-jawed, and glazed over. Mouth breathing, it turns out, changes the physical body and transforms airways, all for the worse. Inhaling air through the mouth decreases pressure, which causes the soft tissues at the back of the mouth to become loose and flex inward, creating less space and making breathing more difficult. Mouth breathing begets more mouth breathing. Inhaling from the nose has the opposite effect. It forces air against all those flabby tissues at the back of the throat, making the airways wider and breathing easier. After a while, these tissues and muscles get toned to stay in that open and wide position. Nasal breathing begets more nasal breathing. None of this should come as much of a surprise. When seasonal allergies hit, incidences of sleep apnea and breathing difficulties shoot up. The nose gets stuffed, we start mouth breathing, and the airways collapse.